Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 116 of the Writership Podcast. I'm Leslie Watts, and today I'm here with Sean Coyne, an editor with more than 25 years of experience and author of the book, The Story Grid, What Good Editors Know. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast. As you know, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. You could make your book happy with reviews. Okay, so today, as I mentioned, I've joined by Sean Coyne, who is the author of The Story Grid. You can find out more about Sean and The Story Grid, the podcast, the book, the course that's available right now at www.storygrid.com. So I want to be sure to mention that. Sean is my teacher and mentor at first from afar, and I recently finished the Story Grid editor certification program, which was amazing. And I think I've mentioned it here and there. I'll be talking more about it in the time to come, but I want to get to the interview, so I want to get through this. What do you need to know to listen to this is that we talk about Chapter 5 from The Animal Farm by George Orwell. And if you are not familiar with the story or if you haven't read it in a while, I urge you to go and read that, because it'll give you context and for our discussion, and we're not able to read it during the episode. So check out the show notes at writership.com/episodes for links where you can read that online. So as I said, yes, I've been following Sean for a long time, and I'm struggling to say concisely what The Story Grid and his work has meant to me in my work, in my, you know, fulfilling part of my purpose here on Earth, which feels like to help people tell their stories. And The Story Grid is a tool that helps me figure out what's working and what's not, so I can give really concise, useful, actionable suggestions to authors. And when you have a good tool, wow, it makes the work better, more fulfilling, more fun. And so I'm so grateful that Sean has taken the time over his entire career to build the tool, but then also share it so generously. So, and the great thing about having your mentor on your show is that you get to learn more all the time. And I had a great reminder that I need to slow down, provide context, and explain things. So I'm taking that to heart and will try to do that more in future episodes. I know that I have a tendency to just dive right in, and I know that sometimes I need to back up and provide context, set the scene, as it were. So again, If you want to check out StoryGrid things, go to www.storygrid.com and check out the course, which is available only for a limited time. That is in which Sean breaks down Pride and Prejudice and why it works so well and what goes into a love story. And even if you're not writing category romance stories, a love story subplot is a great way to add appeal to whatever other genre you have going on in your story. So, and then it also, of course, in the course, he goes over the five commandments of story and the elements of story that you need to know generally. So it's a great course, as I say, even if you're not interested in writing category romance. So enough about this introduction. I want to get to the interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Sean. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Leslie. I'm so happy to be here.
So today you suggested the scene, you know, from Animal Farm, that's chapter 5. And it's a great scene because it's progressive complications and it's got a lot of really good stuff. I really enjoyed this when we talked about it earlier. So I think it's a great choice. I've sent out the information. So if you haven't read the scene, please pause and go do that now. The link is in the show notes at writership.com/episodes. But the basic things that are happening here is we have some backstory with Molly, who is having second thoughts, it seems, about the animal revolution, and it talks about how she's kind of pulled away from the group and eventually fully. But then when we get into the meat of the scene, there's this conflict between Napoleon and Snowball, who are kind of the leaders of the group on the animal farm. And Snowball has an idea to make things easier for the animals. He wants to build this windmill that's going to produce electricity and make their lives easier in a lot of ways. And he's really working hard on it. And Napoleon doesn't want Snowball taking over and becoming the leader because he's got lots of ideas and that sort of thing. And so it's how what unfolds and how Napoleon undermines Snowball's attempts to make things great, better for the animals. So Sean, when you analyze a scene like this and you come to it, you're looking at, right, the five commandments of story. And we've talked about them on the podcast before, but just briefly, could you kind of, in a nutshell, say what they are?
Sure. But before I do, I'd just love to just give a couple of minutes about why I think Animal Farm is such a terrific book to look at if you're interested in story. And the reason why is that it's a society novel, and it's society novels are all about shifts, major shifts in power from one place in society to another. And a lot of times we think of these novels as sort of like War and Peace or Ragtime or these big epic stories that seem to be so impossible to be able to put together. And the brilliance of Animal Farm, I can't overstate how incredible George Orwell came up with this idea. He essentially took the entire Russian Revolution and boiled it down into a very short novel with anthropomorphized beings, animals, to represent all of the major figures in Russian history, from the revolution forward. So my point of doing Animal Farm is to sort of get the message out there that if you want to do a big story about social movements, it doesn't have to be, you know, 400,000 words. It can be really boiled down to its essence, which is what Orwell did here. And this is really about the loss of, you know, the communist sort of sensibility and socialism from the movement from Trotsky and Lenin to, you know, the tyranny of Stalin. So in terms of story, global story, Orwell knows that he needed to have an inciting incident, which is the first thing in the five commandments of storytelling. Now, the inciting incident is the major event that throws all of the characters or a single protagonist out of whack. And the rest of the story is about how those characters or how that specific protagonist metabolizes the inciting incident and resolves it by the end of the story. Now, society novels concern a global value, a global human value, and that value is power. We want to see a shift in power in a society novel, and obviously, you know, Animal Farm has that in spades. It's usually a revolutionary story. And one of the things that we forget about revolutions is that they always come back. So we have the inciting incident of Animal Farm is when the animals overthrow the human farmer to take over the entire farm in England. So now the entire group of animals is taking care of things themselves. And a couple of leaders have stepped forward to, you know, guide the group. None of them feel as if they want to be human. They don't want to be tyrants. They don't want to be that sort of, you know, overpowering force that whips and manages the animals to perform. So the inciting incident is the overthrow of the farm. Now we have progressive complications. What progressive complications are things don't go the way people anticipate. And they get progressively more dangerous, more difficult to overcome, until they get to a place where their irreversible change occurs. And this scene, this chapter five, is a moment of massive progressive complication in the story. Again, this is a very, very short novel that has so much packed into it that it's an amazing work of art. Now, after your progressive complications, you have a crisis. And the crisis always boils down to a question. And there are one of two questions. The question is this going to be a best bad choice or irreconcilable goods? So a best bad choice is a question of whether you do one thing that's bad or do another thing that's worse. Which negative do you have to pick? Irreconcilable goods is when what's good for me is not good for everyone. Do I pick what's good for me or do I pick what's good for everyone? So that's the crisis, and we have a real big crisis in this scene. The climax is the actual decision, what the character or characters did when faced with the crisis moment. Now, that is the climax of the story, and the resolution, which is the fifth element of the five commandments, that is the result of what happened. It is the fallout from the crisis decision. And so this is a movement in a scene. Every scene follows the five commandments, as does every global story. It's like I've talked about this many times before. It's like a series of Russian dolls. You have very small units of story that all have to abide five commandments of storytelling, and they build into larger and larger units that also abide globally the five commandments of storytelling. So the reason why I picked chapter five today is that this is a massive progressive complication in the global story, And also the scene itself is very, very dynamic, and it has a very, very strong progressive complication that isn't irreversible, but it's almost irreversible. So I hope that, you know, I gave you a pretty good overview of the five commandments. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great. And I appreciate that you jumped on why you chose this one and set the scene for that, because I'm not always that good at that. And you did a great job. So thank you.
Sure.
So one thing I want to come back to in a minute is exactly why we have, you know, I don't want to do five commandments. That sounds too bossy, Sean Coyne. And I want to come back to that in a minute. But first, I want to look at the scene and where these parts show up. Because as you said, this is a great example of each of the five commandments within the scene. And also within the global story of the progressive complications, because those have been the progressive complication and like identifying that moment has been something that's been tricky for me, because mm-hmm. there are complications, but what's the one that is, you know, that we label and that we use for identifying whether a scene works. So in this scene, when you know, we have the inciting incident that is, blah, 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 blah. Sorry. As you say, it's a thing that throws the characters and their lives or the situation, everything out of balance, whether we're talking about the scene or the global story.
That's right. And the other thing I'd like to point out before we get into the nitty gritty of it is that mm-hmm. oftentimes scenes are not the smallest unit of story. So there are things called beats, and beats are sort of the actor's medium, and they are small units of story that build up to, you know, the scene level. So for example, you know, one of the ways I analyze scenes is I go back to, years and years ago, I was an actor and I took acting training from an acting school that was founded by David Mamet. And Mamet, of course, being the writer, always wanted to impress upon actors that it is their job to decipher the meaning of the scene by analyzing the scene to understand what the writer's intention was in order to be able to act it. So he came up with these sort of four steps to kind of bring yourself down to a place where you can understand the global movement of the scene in a way that you can act it. So acting is all about sort of these micro beat movements that build into a scene. So Mamet taught through Practical Aesthetics Workshop, which was his acting school, how to actually do this. And there's four questions that you want to answer. And I do this every single time I have to analyze in the scene. And the first question you want to answer is, what are the characters literally doing in the scene? I mean, what are they literally doing? So in this scene, what do you think they're literally doing, Leslie?
Well, they're planning to build a windmill, or at least they're deciding on that.
Yeah, it seems like all of the animals are sort of hanging out and waiting for instructions. You know, they're sort of waiting for the thing to do. What are we supposed to do now? And you know, it's foreshadowed by Molly, which you talked about early on. Molly the horse, who's this vain, beautiful horse, and she likes pretty things. And you don't really get pretty things on Animal Farm because you have to work the whole time. Mm-hmm. So Molly is this figure within the story that believes in sort of the old way. She liked it when she got to wear the ribbons in her hair and human beings were in charge. She didn't have to think that much, and she got these really nice things. So at the beginning of this chapter, we see Molly being sort of under suspicion that she kind of wants to go back to the way the things were before, which is a great foreshadowing moment for the entire novel. And then it progresses into the plans of Snowball. Now, Snowball is a character within the story who believes in the revolution. He believes in all of the animals working together in a united front. And his mission is to help the group. He's put his own sort of ambitions aside, and he's there because he's a very intelligent person, or I think he's a pig.
Yeah.
he's a very intelligent pig. So he is all about, you know, making life better for everyone. So the second question we want to answer in this analysis is, what is the essential action of what the characters are doing in this scene? And I think this goes back to what they're kind of literally doing, which is they're all sort of like waiting around for instructions. So the way I look at it, I see it as they're waiting to be told what to do. They're all being passive, and they're waiting for some force, be it another animal, be it a human being, be it somebody, to tell them what their job is, what they should do next, which is a really, you know, interesting moment in the story. Because what it does is it really opens up the power. The power is sort of up for grabs in this scene. Now, the next thing you want to look at is you want to look at the beginning of the scene and the end of the scene, and you want to say to yourself, what life value has changed for one or more of the characters in the scene? So if we look at this scene globally, we see at the beginning there is a lot of uncertainty, and at the end there's very clear certainty. There's a very clear power shift. There is a movement from somebody being power, not completely in power, to somebody being in complete power by the end of this scene. So it moves from powerless to powerful. And so now we know, wow, there's a value that shifts. That means the story started one place and ended another. Great. That's a scene. That's fantastic. So what kind of value would you highlight if you were taking notes? If you were going scene by scene and saying, which value moved in this scene versus this scene, what I would do is I would say, how do we look at this story? Do we want to look at this story globally in terms of the power base, or do we want to look at it in terms of the individual protagonist who is the most affected in this story? And that person or that being in the story, in my estimation, is Snowball. He's the one who gets, you know, things happen to Snowball in a way that, you know, exile him. So on my spreadsheet, I would want to put something like belonging to exile, because that's very, very specific for the central character in this social story. Now, we could put powerless to powerful if we were looking at it in terms of Napoleon, who is the antagonist of the story. But because Snowball is our central, what Robert McKee calls the center of good. The center of good is the protagonist struggling to do what's right. And oftentimes, if you get lost when you're trying to analyze a scene or analyze a story, it's often a good idea to go back, well, who's the center of good? Who in this scene represents the being that is trying to do the most good for the most people? And that would be Snowball. So that's sort of, you know, our four questions get us to a real sense of the movement, the global movement of the scene. It moves from one character belonging to the group and ends with that character being exiled from the group. Now, what I always like to do after I answer those four questions is to figure out, well, what are the specific five commandments at play in this scene? So let's just go through them, Leslie. So what do you think, what's the inciting incident of the scene, not necessarily a beat? What's the scene's inciting incident?
Yeah, I would say in this scene that it's when Snowball suggests innovating by building the windmill to save labor for the animals.
Exactly, exactly. That is a big inciting incident, because prior to the windmill, the animals are struggling. You know, they're really trying to get in the harvest, and it's not easy. And Snowball has this thought that he can change their lives by creating a technology that will help them in the future. So that incites everybody to be like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. That could be really an amazing thing for our farm. Now, so that's a really solid, active, inciting incident. It's the action of a protagonist that pushes and unbalances everybody else in the scene. Before Snowball came up with the plan, everybody was struggling. Now they've been incited to think of the future. Okay, so that's the inciting incident. What do you think the progressive, the critical progressive complication is after Snowball has introduced his plan?
Yeah, so after the plan, there are lots of little things that happen, but the big thing that happens is that Napoleon pisses on the plans, essentially.
Right.
Yeah, and metaphorically as well as literally.
Yes. And when he does that, that's the turning point of the scene. And the turning point is sort of, it's a little buddy of the progressive complication, in that the turning point is the last progressive complication before the rise of the crisis. It's the thing that turns the scene, shifts it from, belonging to alienation, belonging to possible exile, powerlessness to powerful, if you're looking at it from Napoleon's point of view. Now, again, a lot of these things, you'll hear me using different phrases and different ways of looking at it. And this is the great thing about a well-constructed scene, is that if you look at the scene from different points of view of the characters, you can see different values at play. And, that's when a scene is really working, is when we're really, oh, geez, should I highlight Snowball's point of view or Napoleon's point of view or all the animals or Molly's point of view? That is actually a good thing when you reach that kind of confusion, because what it's saying to you is that the writer has really dumped a tremendous amount of energy into a very short amount of words, so that we can see all of these things at play. Now, this is the turning point, because when Napoleon pisses on the plans, he's alerting everybody, all the other animals, hey, I'm not on board. I don't think Snowball's plan is all that great. And it makes people think, oh my gosh, there's conflict here. What are we going to do? How is this going to shake out? So the turning point, when he pisses on the plans, it gives rise to the crisis in the scene. And the crisis in the scene is, does Napoleon attack Snowball and seize power and risk rebellion of the other animals? So that's like the best bad choice. Mm-hmm. From Napoleon's point of view, if he attacks Snowball, he could gain his power, but he's going to risk the rebellion of the other animals against him. So if he attacks Snowball, he might get attacked by the rest of the animals. The other question is, will he continue to share power and eventually lose power after Snowball's innovations prove successful? So if he doesn't act, then he can share power up until the moment when Snowball's windmill comes online and proves to all the animals that he should be the leader of the group. So the crisis here is very large and it's very clear. So what's the climax of the scene?
Then the climax is when the dogs, there's a pack of dogs and they come and they chase Snowball away.
Yes.
And he's out of there. Like that's so it sort of
it so that should, answers well, the crisis.
Yeah.
The climax answers the crisis question. For Napoleon, the crisis is, should I seize power or should I not? And the climax answers that question. He does seize power. And he attacks Snowball from his goons, his dog goons, and Snowball is run off the farm. Now, what's the resolution after that event?
Yeah, no one speaks up. They just sort of...
That's right.
It just, yeah, it's everyone's like, oh, okay.
No one defends Snowball. No one comes to his rescue.
Right.
So, we often, what I love about this scene is that we often blame the tyrants. We blame them for, making our lives miserable. And the truth is that we, in our silence, gave them the power to begin with. So the animals could have, attacked the goons and Napoleon and saved Snowball and his leadership. And that would have been a much different, trajectory of the story. But again, we're talking about George Orwell using these beings to reflect, the Russian Revolution. And when Stalin came to power and started changing everything, nobody stood up. So this is a very, very powerful scene. And it's the beginning of the revolution, the counter-revolution. The counter-revolution is when Napoleon seizes complete power and brings back things the way they were. He becomes the tyrant. So it's like that Who song, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And Napoleon proves to be a very, very powerful figure. This is a great example of the Five Commandments at play. And every time you go through a scene or you do your own work and you discover that you don't have these things in your scene, you've got a very, very large problem. It means the scene doesn't work. And it means your story is not moving and you have to fix it.
Yeah. So I'm a big story grid proponent, and I've talked about this a lot on the podcast in, different episodes and different contexts. And when we, when we say, okay, if your scene doesn't turn, if your scene doesn't contain the five commandments of story, then, I could envision there being some objections about, well, I don't write in a formulaic way, or I have my own style. I'm trying to innovate story. So when you hear that response, or that, reaction, then what do you think is the, what's the heart of the matter? Like, what's the real nitty gritty, like, this is why we should be looking at these things?
Well, for me, it's the mark of an amateur to shun knowledge that is readily available and has been helping creative people for thousands and thousands of years. It's sort of like somebody saying, I don't want to learn the basics of portrait painting because I'm an abstract expressionist. And so I don't need to know how to make a beautiful sketch of a portrait and all the technique necessary, because I'm going to let my freak flag fly, and my inner genius is going to be released through my, blah, blah, blah. And that's ridiculous, because creativity is about using formal structure in a way that has never been done before. It is not about not having any knowledge whatsoever. If you wanted to build a car, you would certainly want to know, in contemporary society, the internal combustion engine. And if you want to tell a story, you better know the five commandments of storytelling, because those stories, all stories, I've said this a zillion times, but I can never say it enough. All stories, the reason why we love stories is that they're about change. They're about how to deal with things that we did not anticipate, how to metabolize chaos. So in order to be able to do that, we need this formal structure that moves and shows us how we move from one particular place on a value spectrum to another. And the five commandments are the things that push us through that process. So stories can either be prescriptive or cautionary. They either end well, and we try and model our behavior on that person or that protagonist, or they end poorly, and we try to avoid what that protagonist has gone through. And of course, there's all kinds of changes and shifts throughout the story that we enjoy along the way. But the most important thing is that if you don't learn your craft, you will never, ever, you're in for a world of pain. And this whole sort of pantser sensibility is fine. Go have fun. Write free, do whatever you wish, but then go look at your writing and say, has this moved my story forward, or is this just a bunch of descriptive stuff that I riffed on for 3 hours that doesn't really move the story in any way, shape, or form? And the way to see if your story is moving is by tracking the value shifts of individual scenes. And if your scene's values don't shift, it's not a scene. It's a bunch of description. It's a bunch of exposition. It's, it's flowery language that has no point other than to show how wonderful you can put a sentence together. It's hard for me to really combat people who are so committed to that point of view, because I just can't help them. What happens is that, you reach a point in your life where you understand that your work just isn't being enjoyed by other people. And if you write for yourself and you don't want anybody else to read your work, go to it. Do whatever you want. But if you wish to change people's lives and to write stories that can, make them really think about their worldview, you've got to know the tools to make those clear story arguments. And these tools, I didn't invent these. I didn't come up with this. This is from Aristotle to Plato to Robert McKee to Friedman to so many people have written about writing, and they all share this core sensibility that stories are about change, and the way to make them work is by using this structure. And it doesn't mean that you can't be creative. The way to be creative is to have very confined choices. And then when you innovate, they're remarkable.
Yeah, I think about sometimes like a sonnet or a haiku, and you wouldn't just, say, you can't just throw out the structure of those poems and then call it a sonnet or call it a haiku. Like that there is, not only is that, like, that's part of the definition, like that's what it is, but also there's something, the reason we don't want to necessarily throw out the structure is that there's something conveyed through that in the structure that helps, that says more than the content. And so when a story does the, you know, has these moves, and you've likened it to the Kubler-Ross grief
yes.
and change process, right?
That yes.
it's the same kind of movement that we go through naturally. And some people can, you know, they have this sort of talent, whatever, you know, they have a natural ability at it. Doesn't mean they don't have to work, but they can, they yes. don't have to, you know, they don't have to grind on the early stuff as much, on the, you know, on the basic stuff. But that doesn't, yeah, they still have to work. And I think if you don't have that natural kind of ability, you know, the same way somebody is a natural, is naturally an athlete or
yeah.
is naturally good at, you know, spatial analysis and that kind of thing, but you still work at it. And the thing that was, there are two things actually that are, were really hopeful for me when I discovered the story grid. And the first is that it's just work. There are specific things that you can do that will produce results. And coming from a New England background, that made perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I love about it is it breaks very large problems down into very small practical things. So the other thing about structure is that it's inherently built within all of our DNA. To be human, we are the only beings on the planet who use story. I mean, I think orangutans can understand a simple story, but not at the depth and level that we can. We understand structures from haiku to the epic narrative, you know, Game of Thrones. And that's because they're all built on these five commandments. They were all built on moments when we are confused and things do not, you know, obey in the ways that we think they are until we reach a place where we have to make a decision. A crisis arises where we have to make a decision. We make a decision and the result is the result. That is how we process information. So in all story structure, those are the fundamental elements in every level and every element and every piece of every little bit of story. So yeah, there are some people who can sit on a bar stool and tell incredible stories and have the whole crowd laughing. And they are born storytellers. They don't know that they have to bring, you know, suspense and mystery and all this stuff to bear, and that they have to, you know, reach this place where the audience doesn't know what the character is going to do, one thing or the other thing or what. And then climactically, you know, they deliver a payoff that makes everybody surprised and excited. They don't know all that sort of machinery. But if you point it out to them, they go, yeah, of course, that's obvious. And so if you can look at the machinery and say to yourself, well, I want to tell a story. I always wanted to write a great story about a master detective. How would I go about doing something like that? Well, geez, wouldn't you want to look at all the books that were great master detectives and analyze them and see, you know, how those stories worked? And then you would want to say to yourself, well, gee, they have this moment when there's a dead body. So that kind of kicks off the story. And then they have the moment where they identify the perpetrator. That I got to have that scene. And then, you know, they have a moment when the perpetrator either gets away with the crime or you know, gets his just desserts. Oh, I got to have that scene too. So these are not like super complicated concepts, but we often get so lost in our desire to be, you know, lyrical and Fitzgeraldian and have the perfect description that we lose the forest through the trees. And we don't understand that stories are, you know, these really, really deeply ingrained elements within all of us. And that if we can tap into those five commandments and make sure that our work has them, we're going to get closer to being a better storyteller. And the more you work at it, yeah, the more work you do, the more applied work that you do, the better. A lot of people say, to be a writer, all you have to do is write. Well, yes and no. You've got to do the right kind of practice. You've got to understand and analyze and use the analytical part of your brain as much as the creative side of your brain, which comes up with crazy ideas. You have to guide your muse. Your muse is going to help you, but you can't depend on them just feeding you a story. It's just not going to happen that way. The muse only speaks to those who are doing the work, who are banging it out, who are saying to themselves, there's something wrong with my scene and I don't know what it is. Geez, I guess I'm going to have to analyze it like Sean Coyne suggested, and I really don't want to do it, but I'm going to just try it anyway. And guess what will happen is that when they do that, the muse will speak to them and say, oh boy, you didn't have the turning point progressive complication. So you didn't turn the scene, you just had a crisis arise without anything turning it. Oh, I know what I have to do. I have to have somebody slap somebody else in the face so that it gives rise to the crisis. So the thing I love, now the story grid is something that I've developed over, a 25-year career as an editor. And it's really a way of just communicating with writers so that their intentions can be more clear. If you ask a writer, what do you intend to write? And they can answer that question very, well, then the toolbox that you can give them will make that message all the more clear. Now, if somebody just wants to write for writing's sake, the toolbox will make them think about what they want to say. It will make them think about what kind of story they want to tell. What is important to them? Are they really concerned about justice? Well, maybe they should write a crime story. Are they concerned about power? Maybe they should write a society novel. Are they concerned about love? Maybe they should write a love story. All of these sorts of values that we all care about are the ways in which to discover the things that we need to write about. Because if you're fascinated by a particular value, chances are is that you're not sure yourself. And the process of writing is not only bringing a story to life, it's self-discovery. As you are working, you find out things about yourself that you never, ever thought about before. So for all those people who say, I don't want to do the story grid stuff, it's ridiculous, it's not doing anything for me, then fine. Just, writing is about self-discovery. And what I think they will self-discover in the future is that structure and craft is an integral part of being a pro. And they will learn it, and they will become better, and their stories will affect more and more people.
Yes. I'm like cheering over here. Okay, and so, yeah, so the thing about it is, too, is I would, yeah, if you feel resistance to it, then do what Stephen Pressfield says and use that as a compass, because yes. It's... your resistance is pointing to where you need to go, and just try it. Like, seriously, try a scene. It's been amazing for me as an editor to use this tool, because every time I face a story, I'm like, oh, is it going to work? Is it going to, the grid, meaning the story grid methodology, like, will it work? Will it help me figure out what this author needs to focus on? And it's like magic. I mean, it's everything I love in a tool, because you do very specific things and then the muse speaks to me in terms of, what does the story need? What's missing? Because, the vague advice or feedback that, oh, this just didn't work for me, or I want a little more something here, that's not helpful or useful because it doesn't really tell you what's wrong, and it doesn't tell you what to do to fix it. So it's very frustrating.
Well, yes, and also the more scene work you do of other people's work, the more reading you do, the more analysis of masterworks that you do, the better language you'll have to communicate with another writer. So, for example, if somebody's having a problem doing a hero at the mercy of the villain scene in the thriller, if you're well-read, you can say, well, turn to, you know, page 287 of Silence of the Lambs. That's the beginning of the, you know, the hero at the mercy of the villain scene. Read that scene and see how Thomas Harris solved the same problems that you're facing. Because that way, you will be able to understand how, you know, you'll be inspired to be able to fix your own problems. And the more of these scenes that you have in your inventory of your brain, the easier it will be to communicate with people who are having trouble. So people who say, well, I don't get the five commandments, well, you can say, well, go watch this scene on television, and you'll find yourself, once you get the methodology down, that you analyze everything and you can't help yourself anymore. And you'll say, oh, yeah, well, that movie didn't work because it didn't really have a compelling crisis. So what they did is they just had a lot of bombs go off with no crisis. So that's why it didn't really pay off. It was a lot of events that didn't have any real story movement to them. The more scenes that you analyze, like we just did with Animal Farm, the better equipped you will be to work on your own stuff. It's a way of communicating with another fellow writer who cares about what you care about in a way that's extremely helpful. It's not bullshit like, oh, I just didn't get it, or, you know, I think your third act needs work. That doesn't help anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And people ask me if, you know, if doing this work, and, you know, you can't watch movies or TV the same way or read books the same way, you know, kind of after you've done this work, and people will say, oh, doesn't that ruin it for you? And no, absolutely not.
No, it's like being a great car mechanic and seeing, you know, hearing an engine, you know what kind of carburetor they have in it, right? It doesn't mean that person isn't enjoying looking at the car and listening to it. In fact, they enjoy it more, because when you can see the hidden work and all the details, it's like seeing each brushstroke that Manet made to paint. It's when you're in a museum and you look really close, you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe he did that. And then you step back and it's, you know, lilies on a pond, and you go, how did he do that? And it's the same thing with story. If you can see how the beats are building up to a scene, and the scene is building up to a sequence, and the sequence is building up to an act, and the act is building up to, you know, the global story, it's thrilling to be able to see mastery of an artist at that level of detail. And the more story gridding you do, the more you understand just how. I mean, I did a big thing on Pride and Prejudice. Jane Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice in 1813. It's the exact same tools. You look at Beowulf, Gilgamesh. They're all the same tools as Silence of the Lambs, but they're completely different stories and completely different works of art, but they're all using the same structural foundation. So to say I don't use structural foundation and is ludicrous. I mean, even avant-garde absurdist writers like Beckett, they were masters of craft before they even attempted to do Waiting for Godot. Waiting for Godot is a masterwork because he understood story structure in such a way that he kept pulling the rug out from under you. I mean, the entire play is waiting for somebody who never shows up. And it works so well, and it's ridiculous and funny and absurd, and it's a masterwork because he uses story structure and reinverts it and twists it constantly. so that he sets up expectations and pulls the rug out from under you. That's what you do with the five commandments of storytelling. That's an absurdist work that is a work of genius. That's the biggest innovation that people say, oh, Thomas Beckett didn't use any structure in his story. Baloney, he did. He knew it so well that he was able to play with it in a way that nobody else could.
Yeah, and that brings up a good point, because sometimes there are flukes, right? You know, sometimes a story that really doesn't work ends up, it gets some social proof, and it ends up, you know, on the New York Times bestseller list, or, you know, or doing well because of word of mouth. But that's, you know, exactly that, a fluke, or somebody who has, you know, has a reputation otherwise, or that kind of thing. And the average writer can't depend on that kind of, you know, coincidence, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That stuff is out of your control. And it's a very difficult thing for people to understand that, no, I can't guarantee you a New York Times bestseller based upon the story grid structure. What I can guarantee is that you'll become a better writer, and that you will get closer and closer to a work of art that will live longer than you do. Now, there are a lot of people who can write bestsellers because they know global story structure extremely well, and they can hit the moments globally in the global story so that we forgive a lot of, you know, not so great scenes, some scenes that don't work, a lot of flat dialogue, cliche stuff, because they have a really good, they're like the great barstool storyteller. We forgive, you know, he contradicts himself because he's had too much to drink and he'll tell a story, but he will forgive some of that stuff because the payoff is so good. Now, we can't control the way people will consume the story. All we can control is the craftsmanship. So if you're building a great piece of furniture, you can't count on people understanding that you didn't use high-powered machinery to make it, but instead you made every dowel yourself and hand polished everything. All you can want to do is create a work that through time can really attach to people, like Pride and Prejudice, which is the preeminent love story of all time. Now, Jane Austen, her craft on the page is so impeccable that her story didn't do so well when she published it. It sort of came and went, and it was fine. And she had to keep writing. She never really made a living writing until after her death. Now, sometimes a great writer writes a great book, and it's a bestseller. I think Anne Tyler's The Accidental Tourist is a great work, and it was a bestseller, and it was a great movie, too. Well, good for her. But she didn't write that book to be a New York Times bestseller. She wrote it because it was a really, really important story that she wanted to explore. And that's what we want to do. We want to enjoy the work. The work is the thing that helps us understand ourselves. So this is the great thing about writing, is that it's a process of coming to understand yourself. And in that process, you can create something that's universal that helps other people understand themselves better. But it's a process of self-discovery as you're working through an idea. And the ideas come to you from the muse. The muse delivers ideas to you that you need to consider. So the work is how you dig underneath all the rubble in your deep, dark unconscious to find that thing that is really important to you. Now, Tim Grawl and I have been working for 2 years on the podcast, the Story Grid podcast, on his novel. And that process hasn't really been all about the five commandments of storytelling all week. What it's been is Tim picking out the rubble in his own subconscious to discover why he wants to write the specific kind of story. And it's taken him a long time to figure out, oh my gosh, I want to write an action labyrinth story about a young girl who matures in a very dystopian world. And that's mirrors Tim's own journey. Tim started not knowing anything about writing. And he had to go through a labyrinth of maze in order to learn. And isn't it interesting that he's writing a fictional story about the same process? And these are the things that you discover as you do the work. And you'll remember what I said to preface this. For 2 years, Tim and I have gotten on the phone every single week. For 2 years. Now, is his book going to be a New York Times bestseller? Probably not. Maybe. We don't know. Who knows? But what we do know is that Tim has become a much better writer, and he's discovered things about himself that he never knew before. So that's why you want to be a writer. It's not to be on the New York Times list. If that happens, God bless you. Good for you. Move on. What's your next project?
Yes, yes. It's been really fun watching the story unfold, both Tim's story as a writer and his story on the podcast. And there's just, yes, there's so much good stuff there. And that's a great point about how we are getting to know ourselves through the writing, through the process of revision and analyzing, and that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the writing process is a process of self-reflection, and it's painful. It's supposed to be painful. There are things about ourselves that we don't really want to deal with. And when you're a writer, you get the opportunity to deal with that stuff by putting it into a third-party amorphous thing. And when you do that, it allows you to get a perspective that you never would have had otherwise. And so the process of writing is a worldview shift, just as the novel itself and the story itself usually has some sort of worldview shift in it too. So, you know, Steve Pressfield, my good buddy in War of Art, and a lot of his writing, it all boils down to, we are entitled to our labor, but we're not entitled to the fruits of our labor. And that sounds silly, but it's absolutely true. And it's from Krishna, you know, it's from the Bhagavad Gita from thousands of years ago. And it really makes sense. There's nothing better in life than to have purpose, to have a goal, to have something that really, really takes all of your energy, and you have to work at it, and you're not very good, and maybe get a little bit better, but then you get knocked down again, but then you keep trying. Those are the things that are meaningful. Those are the things that keep us excited about our world. They help us deal with our chaotic circumstances. They ground us. And any writer living today, you know, it's like Steve tells a great story when, you know, this was years ago when he couldn't, you know, get published by anyone. He used to take years off at a time and go work on novels that he couldn't sell. But one year, he took off for the entire summer and didn't talk to anyone and just worked and worked and worked. At the end of the summer, he heard about this thing called Watergate. And it was about how Richard Nixon, the president of the United States, left office. He was so engrossed in his work, he didn't even pay it. He missed Watergate. And that is a gift from God, because his work really, really consumed him to the point where he wasn't distracted by things that were out of his control. And we live in a world that's very difficult to understand. So having a craft, having writing, having creativity as your source to keep you grounded is extraordinarily important today. So don't do it just to be on the New York Times bestseller list, because that is really not going to give you any happiness at all. It really won't. I've known so many people who have been on it. I've had bestsellers myself, and you always think it's going to be amazing, and it's not. It's really empty. You feel terrible, and you just then you put all this burden on yourself. But when you're working on a project that's just starting as a kernel in your brain, and you take it and you take it and you take it further and further each day, that's what's meaningful. That's what's great. That's why we're in it. And the Story Grid is a way to help you move that little boulder further up the hill.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I could talk to you about this forever. You know, we're on the same page when it comes to meaning and purpose and what stories can do for ourselves and for others. But I do want to let you get back to your regular life. Before we go, I do want to mention that the Love Story course, where you go in depth into Pride and Prejudice, is going to be available. The online course is going to be available again. And I had the privilege of doing that when it was live in February in New York City. And it was amazing. And
oh, good.
I had read all of Jane Austen's books before and enjoyed them, but the like getting into it the way that you did and seeing the levels of craft involved in that story just gave me a completely new appreciation. And as you mentioned, you know, a love story subplot is a great way, you know, is a great addition to most stories. And then the, you know, courtship love stories aren't so bad if you hope to make a decent living at your writing.
Oh, absolutely. Love stories are 70% of the market. There's no question about those are the most commercially viable stories. And even the crime stories, thrillers, if there's a love story subplot, they're really important. We're not going to repeat that course ever again live. And I'm not sure how many more times we're going to offer it, but this is only the second time it's been on sale, and I'm going to add a pretty cool thing for Story Grid planning for people who want to plan their next novel. It's actually for people who are going to do NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month in November. So that's going to be part of the course too. I think it's extraordinarily helpful in establishing all of the principles of Story Grid. Yes, we use love story as sort of the case study, but it's all the fundamental stuff. And, you know, courses moving forward will rely upon this foundational material from here on out. So if you're interested in the Story Grid, it's a great introduction to all the material in a way that you can stop and start and hear me say it a million times. And the questions are probably the ones that are going to be really the most helpful too, because we have a lot of Q&A in there as well. So, if you're into it, you want to try it. I think it's available just for October 16th through the 20th. And that's at storygrid.com.
Right. Yes. And I'll include links for everything in the show notes. So if anybody's on the go and they need to check it later, then yeah. And I highly recommend it. As you said, it's the Story Grid principles are in there, and it's just a great examination and demonstration of the way it all works and a great story and how a great story works. So yes, I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful.
Oh, good.
So, okay. Well, I'm over the moon grateful for you taking the time to do this. I know that this is your, you know, part of your passion in life is talking about story but I also know that this takes you away from other activities. So thank you so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was my pleasure.
For this week's editorial mission, look for the 5 commandments of story. Choose a scene from a book you love and identify the 5 commandments. So you're looking for the inciting incident, the progressive complications that lead to a turning point, the crisis question, climax, and resolution. And if you have trouble remembering what they are, then stop by the show notes for episode 116, where I'll have a quick description as well as links to more detailed posts on storygrid.com. So once you feel comfortable with identifying those in stories that you read, you know, your favorite stories, then I want you to look at one of your own scenes and review that and see if you've missed any of those 5 commandments. If you haven't reached the revision stage yet with your work in progress, then I want you to try to like plan out a scene that you haven't yet written by identifying the points that you're going to need to hit. So that the point is that you can use this as a revision tool, but the story grid is also an outstanding planning tool. So if you struggle with this, whether it's with your own scene or in identifying it within a scene of a book you love, then leave me a comment in the show notes or write to me at hello@writership.com, because I don't want you to get stuck with this. It's such an amazing tool, and once you kind of get comfortable with it, you're going to be so excited, but I don't want you to get stuck. So if you do, let me know. Okay. Remember, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.HappyBookReviews.com, because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews. And as you also probably know, Jim Kukral and the Author Marketing Club cover hosting and technical support for the show, but our Patreon crew supports our time in preparation. We have a new reward I've mentioned for the Quartermaster's level, and it's the Writership Podcast Book Club. Of course, it's not just any book club. Each month, I'll choose a book from your suggestions, and I'll read and analyze it the way I would for a StoryGrid diagnostic. Then we'll discuss it in a recorded call. So if you want more information about that or other ways to support the podcast, you can visit patreon.com/writership. If you enjoy the show and want to show your love, please leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you want to have your 5 pages reviewed, please visit writership.com/submissions. Finally, to find out more about Sean Coyne and the Story Grid, visit storygrid.com. Don't forget to check out the Story Grid workshop, which is available for only a few days. You can do that at www.storygrid.com/programs/story-grid-workshop/, or you can visit the show notes. That's it for episode 116. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.